Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia Garcia Herrero.
And today we will discuss about the impact of the current COVID wave and related lockdowns on Chinese and global economy. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter Zhonghua Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Joining our conversation today is Jörg Wuttke, who is the president of the EU Chamber of Commerce in China, as well as vice president and chief representative of BASF China. Hi, Jörg. Thanks for connecting with The Sound of Economics.
Thank you for inviting me. Today, I will speak on behalf of the European Chamber. So my opinion will not reflect on what BASF is thinking, but I'm very happy to be on the show.
Thank you. Great. And you are in Beijing at the moment. And obviously, since the topic of our conversation is going to be exactly what's going on, perhaps before giving a short snap, how is it like your daily life being affected at the moment? Of course, Beijing is not as in lockdown as Shanghai, which we are going to speak about it in a second. But I imagine that you also feel on your practical day-to-day what is going on in terms of this wave.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very peculiar situation. It feels like the news is tightening. You know, it starts with tests once in a while and you have more tests to do. And then second, you see that the soccer the tournament for the boys is cancelled. Next thing you see is you have to test three times. Next is that you have friends who actually are in lockdown in some parts of the city. And we talk about numbers that are insignificant, 10 here, 5 there, and so forth. And then the next is you see that the school is out and we have to have the kids on online learning since yesterday. And of course, the direction of this is like, is it going to be Shanghai 2.0? I really find this very hard to believe that the capital of China is going in a lockdown and has these dramatic pictures of the empty streets. Just imagine a drone flying over Zhengguanwei, passing the Tiananmen, and there's nobody. I cannot imagine. But, you know, the fear is high and the capital has to be prepared. And believe me, my wife stocked up on all kinds of groceries.
What you're saying in terms of what's going on indeed reminds the situation of Shanghai, which started exactly in the same way you're describing. Like there were very staggered approach before going on the 31st of March in full lockdown, which is still going on. So the Shanghai case, 25 million residents, and we've seen not just a surge in cases, but also we've been seeing something like 30,000 medics, 2,000 military workers have been dispatched to the city. That's according to state media, so we are just mentioning official numbers over there. And also we've been seeing so far, I mean, in Shanghai already we've seen a rare surge of public frustration and criticism towards the government. The situation is extending, as you said, beyond Shanghai. But I like to start with Shanghai because it's China's international financial center. So that's also how we started to wanted to reflect on that and would like to ask you for an overview because not just on, let's say, the actual measures and the daily life of people which is being affected, as you just mentioned, even family life and so on, but we are also seeing some challenges for China's growth target, which was set in early March. This growth target of 5.5%, which was announced, now with all this background of lockdowns and new measures, all eyes are on any announcement on new policies to sustain China's growth in 2022. So maybe you can give us an overview of what is going on, you know, going a little bit beyond the actual situation which we are seeing on newspapers and media, and looking a bit more in depth into the economic situation and the impact that this is having.
Well, you have to keep in mind it is the financial and economic center of China, and it has the kind of self-confidence or the kind of exudes this kind of we are better and not Beijing and, you know, the others, provincial and so forth. So there was a bit of hubris in the beginning. We can manage, we trace better than anybody else. And the fact is that Shanghai went down in flames like this is just unbelievable. If it happens to the best run city in China, and it now turns out to be maybe it's not the best run city, then what is going to happen to provincial towns that are definitely less protected? And it hits the most prosperous city. You know, it has a government that has very deep pockets. They can do one test every day, and it costs them about 200, 250 million renminbi, you know. By the way, a shot, a jab is cheaper than testing, but, you know, the toolbox doesn't have jabs right now. It's only the sledgehammer, only the testing. So there we go. It went down, and nobody saw it coming. We had in our factories, of course, the big problem that we thought we can do it in closed loops, so we kept people there. But then we realized after 1 or 2 weeks, we can't exchange the people. We cannot take them back because nobody wants them in the local committees, and we can't get people from these houses out in order to replace them because we get told, you know, if they leave our committee area, then they cannot return, you know. So you have people working 4 weeks in factories, and you can imagine what it does. I think there is going to be a deep psychological hurt for the whole city and for the people definitely as well. They didn't expect it. B, 4 weeks is a long time. In Chinese, you can't beat the Chinese on good sense of humor. As they say, you know, get me into a prison because I get 3 times a day food and I know when it's over. We don't know when it's going to be over. You know, speculation is that it's going to be May 9th. That would mean nearly another 10 days, but nobody knows. And the impact on the economy is drastic. I will launch on May 5th a survey that we have just finished 2 days ago. And you can imagine it's the first big survey after the 1st of April. The Finns and the Swedish went first. And you can imagine what it takes us. 70, 80, 90% will be very unhappy where it is. And of course, the impact is felt already now with transportation down. I think it was 71% year on year. The economy is going to take a hit. Services are going to go belly up. It's just going to be dramatic, you know. And also, it's very interesting to see if Shanghai is down, the damage is not limited to Shanghai. It spills over to Nanjing, spills over to Zhejiang, and even more faraway places. As I understand, as of this week, there are no more trains and connections going between Nanjing and Shanghai because Nanjing is absolutely hysterical about the Omicron crisis. So what does it do to the city? Well, first of all, again, people will be very unhappy and will be very unhappy for a long, long period of time. But secondly, of course, it will show that the policy is wrong and there has to be a change in other cities. Now, there is a discussion going on, which I'm partly to be blamed for, about, you know, we have to change the policy into a different kind of vaccine and vaccine faster and more often. Many people only have 2 vaccine shots, which is not good enough. Chinese vaccine with 2 shots doesn't protect you at all. The 3rd shot is huge difference, makes it very, very safe in many ways. But again, the mutation of Omicron is much better dealt with the gold standard of vaccination, which is mRNA. And they have a factory in Shanghai to produce mRNA by Fosun. And because of national pride, they don't let it run because China wants to export vaccine and that doesn't square well with the import of vaccines. So in a way, it is a very peculiar, the situation we are in. Of course, what it also does is that people will put money on hold. Many of our members, I can't say the number, otherwise I leak too much, but a majority of our companies actually reconsider China's strategy and put it on pause. That does not mean we're leaving China, not at all. The market size, the potential is still there, but we put it on pause. And it's very interesting to see that actually, you know, people are rerouting the exports from Shanghai to other places, meaning they buy maybe from the Philippines, Vietnam, and so forth. Those are the importers based in Europe. But at the same time, also investment is being put on hold because you can't, frankly, visit the city. And what is also very important is that you can't have the typical Chinese governor, mayor going to our headquarters and do advertisement for their city. And that's very important. We had many cases where actually that was always the best selling point. Now, this void is being filled by mayors and by governors from other countries. They go to our headquarters and say, "Ooh, you know, we are all of a sudden look much smarter." And then our top executives, they can fly to the Vietnam or to Singapore, Indonesia, no problem. So China is missing out on future investment while actually it needs our investment, in particular on the high tech sector. So the damage that will happen is also medium and long term noticeable. And the last point from my side is the biggest hit has been China is not predictable anymore. China used to be very predictable. Its growth, it has a responsive government, and it is an economy well run by capable administrators. And still, I believe the economic administrators are very capable and very good, as a matter of fact. I know many of them, and very, very worried, you know, that this goes down the wrong way. But we are stuck in a narrative that is pleading for stability, or we cannot have so many dead people, and it doesn't help. So in a way, we have all of a sudden a bit of a rift in the leadership of those that actually plead for a change of game and those that actually think like it has to go on like that. I don't know when this is going to be resolved, but definitely the victim floating down the Yangtze River is called predictability. Shanghai has lost its allure. Shanghai was aiming for being an international city, but now it will take a long time to come back. I'm convinced it has the ability. Again, the economic leadership is normally very, very good, but it has to rebuild trust.
Thank you, Jörg. And this is extremely interesting. I have a lot of questions from what you just said. But before that, I would like to get Alicia's point of view and first comments and reactions to these gloomy scenarios that you are just depicting.
Thank you, Giuseppe. Thank you, Jörg. I'm not sure I'm the right person to react because I'm going to be gloomier if possible. And that's the problem that, you know, we're trying to have an interesting podcast, but that doesn't mean we need to kill the audience. And I'm going to try very hard not to, but it's going to be hard. So hearing Jörg and having gone through Hong Kong and now, you know, Taipei, I feel that, and I think this is Jörg's basically title. I couldn't have thought of a better title of his interview on exactly this topic that maybe we can even distribute around if requested. But I think it's all about this narrative. I mean, once you convince people that what you were doing is great, which probably was at the time with a different COVID and, you know, different circumstances and when people weren't vaccinated, etc., people actually believed it. And this is why it is so hard, because you have a population which just can't get away from this idea that this is very dangerous. So it's not only about the government or, you know, I guess the government is trapped in this idea. How can I convince people? How can I let people know that what I said before was right then, but isn't right anymore without looking strange? Let's put it this way. So the costs of the whole thing are related to somehow, we could say, dying of success. I mean, you were successful in what you were doing, and now you happen to be unsuccessful doing the very same thing for a problem that looks very similar. We know it's not similar, but it's hard to let people understand that it isn't so similar. And by the way, we all have issues in China in terms of efficacy of vaccination. It might be better than many Westerners think, but still, I mean, there's many question marks that probably could create a lot of uncertainties at the government level as to what way to go. I mean, and also the fact that if you've kept on saying that lives are more important than anything, I mean, that anything is everything, yeah? I mean, so how do you get away with, okay, this is the trade-off? I mean, that we are economists and most of the people listening to us, at least, I mean, the trade-off isn't there. The economic trade-off isn't there. And as much as it may look morally wonderful, the question is it really? I mean, is that the reason? Because there are many other types of deaths in China nowadays because of hospitals being the way they are. I mean, there's many things we could bring to the table. I'm going to end here by saying that there has to be a trade-off. Somebody has to put the trade-off on the table, and there has to be a recognition that flexibility, and Chinese are so good at this, is essential because this virus is mutating and we need to understand this. So, you know, I don't know when this is going to happen. Perhaps the only way to answer this question is how bad does it have to become for things to change? Because I can't think of any other way out of this question. So maybe that would be my question for her. How bad does it need to get before we see a major change?
Well, let me also step back a little bit and say that we had our survey done in January, February, and the survey results of our 1,800 members in 9 cities across China was really good. I mean, 2021 was a good year. Manufacturing, very often double-digit growth, profitable, and so on and so on. And that actually then made us do a new survey because, of course, we this survey is totally irrelevant now in a sense that it gives you the direction of where China's heading. Because people have been actually quite optimistic about more investment, more this, more that. And so for us, this survey I launched on the 5th will be actually the yin to the yang, meaning that there's really going to be a total different outlook. So base load in the European business community is like, we like to be here. We are happy in China. We lament about all these politicization and all of the above, but we want to be here. And so that actually makes it a bigger shock because it feels like we came quite with a high speed. First quarter was wonderful for many of us still. And then 28th of March, our sales collapsed. And we had this this kind of situation we're in. But also it comes at the most inconvenient period of time because China was already facing economic headwinds. The real estate crisis, which is major, they try to resolve it by making it easier to obtain a mortgage, but it makes no difference. It doesn't make any difference if you have a better mortgage, if you can't leave your house in the first place in order to buy another apartment. And second, of course, the car industry was taking a massive hit. And the headwinds, of course, were aggravated also by last year's slaughterhouse on the internet, the gaming, all of those companies. So what I fear most, and to Alicia's question, how worse does it have to get, is what I fear most is unemployment. In particular, as we have 10.8 million college students entering the workforce, and they wanted a nice job, you know, but if you're in a lockdown in Shanghai or in many other cities, looking for a job is a bit tedious. And then, of course, you have the service sector, which is being exposed to all kinds of clampdowns. Now, will the government be able to safeguard these entrepreneurs? And then you have, of course, the frustrated big tech companies that have laid off tens of thousands of people because of all the restrictions that came up last year. And when you talk to those people, they say, you know, why should I put so much effort and into my venture capital, into my new ideas that I have, if actually it's going to be taken away from me? And then on top of it comes, again, also the kind of tension with the United States. You know, can I list my company? Can I IPO it? Can I work together with foreign countries in order to do all of this? One thing I can tell you, the most hit group here in our membership are lawyers. And lawyers, for the simple reason, is that nobody does M&As these days anymore because you can't travel. And you can't see the assets over here, you can't investigate. And so when I just look at the latest data that came out from Finland and Sweden, that is April data, it's very interesting to see that 60% of their Scandinavian headquarters actually see China as a political risk. 60%. China was never a political risk before. But of course, it comes one to the other. It was Ukraine. Our survey covers Ukraine. In particular, as the German survey in March indicated, that 50% of headquarters are putting China projects on hold because of Ukraine and because Ukraine's connotation to Taiwan. You know, what is going to happen if, you know, the Chinese do to Taiwan of what the Russians have done to things? So uncertainty about the predictability, will China be a peaceful player, is all-time high. And it puts, again, a damper on investment plans. And then, of course, the expatriates, people are leaving. You know, it's one thing to have localization in operations and sales and running factories, which runs really, really well. I mean, we all have great colleagues. But at the same time, future business, research and development, the connection to the headquarters in order to get the money on the ground here. That's mostly done by high-profile expats. And we have lost already half, at least half of the expat community over the last 2 years. I give you one example. Germans in Shanghai used to be about indispensable. Can we do stuff without them? Of course we can. But we cannot do much more than we would do with these people. And what is lacking because of this interconnection, also Chinese are finding it very difficult to come to our headquarters, partly also because since August, China refuses to issue new passports or to extend existing passports, meaning there's a break in communication, a break in understanding between headquarters, Europe, and China, which is really incredible. Because, for example, G20 meetings are G19 meetings. Chinese leadership never pops up. Yesterday, the German chancellor was in Japan, and of course, the Japanese prime minister is traveling. I mean, guests, they bring business people along, we make business deals and so forth. It's not going to happen. And the online exchange that happens between Europe and China is staged, and it is unfortunately not very good. So we are running into the risk of misunderstandings, despite the fact that actually we might have a lot of things in common. On the 25th of May, I'm going to launch a major report called Decarbonization, which shows the potential for European business to help China to reach 2030, 2060 goals. And then the beginning of June, on the 8th, I will launch another report by the Chamber together with Merricks on research and development possibilities in China. So there are areas where we actually can engage well, but at this stage, it's very hard. The noise level on bad news is so high, it's very hard to focus on the good parts.
Again, Jörg, you are not bringing us good news. I mean, of course. My question, which follows up what you mentioned, you give us a very good and clear picture about how foreign companies operating in China are living all this. So the question, which is always the elephant in the room, or the question that we together with Alicia in our series of podcasts, we are more and more asking at every single topic that we are unfortunately coming back, which is the issue of decoupling. I mean, the way you mentioned, the way you describe what is going on the ground from the inside of the life of foreign companies operating in China, all points to that direction, like you're describing how decoupling is happening on the ground. And obviously, there is a difference between hearing this from a newspaper article just speaking or a political science opinion piece where you just hear about it on the bigger schemes of things. But the way you describe it is really like making it real and tangible of what's actually being lost on the ground. And I mean, I would like to ask you to do a bit this exercise from your perspective. How do you analyze these things that you are observing on the ground on the bigger, broader kind of consequences that this is going to have on global value chains, but in general, you know?
In January last year, I launched a paper also done with Merricks about decoupling. And it was a very technical paper looking into decoupling coming out of the push from the Trump administration. The export sanctions, the investment sanctions, and so on and so on. And of course, the Chinese attempt in order to put everything in-house and produce it here. And where was European business going for this one? And I followed it up in September with our customary position paper, always a solid 400 plus pages, 900 recommendations for the leadership here to say, guys, if you want to actually decouple, and you call it self-reliance, dual circulation, you can manage, no problem. You have a great economy, domestic economy, but it comes at a cost, And there was this wonderful World Bank study that they provided us so we could print it, was showing that actually China has three alternative pathways to go. And to make it more interesting, we actually asked the World Bank to benchmark it with Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. And it was also very telling from the year of opening up how these four economies, including the mainland, actually developed so along the same lines. So people tend to forget how strong Japan, Korea, and Taiwan were growing initial phase. But also interesting, China, as it was trying to decouple more, actually fell behind the other economies, GDP per capita in power purchasing parity terms. So we said already, guys, you know, you're very good, I know, but times 1.4 billion, that camouflages the fact that actually you could be better, in particular when you look at the economies of Korea and Taiwan. So we asked the World Bank to look into the future. And there was, of course, muddling through the obvious a little bit here, a little bit there. China will double its per capita very soon, but will fall far more behind Korea and Japan and Taiwan. Actually, not too much with Japan. It resembles more Japan in many ways. And then there was this kind of self-reliance pathway, which indicates that China will have slow growth, but still significant. Again, everything times 1.4 billion. And there was this kind of, Liu He has free reign and can do whatever he wants to do. China globalizes, connects again, and China takes off like a rocket. I mean, really. It has huge potential, overtakes Japan soon, and comes close to Korea, overtakes Taiwan, and so forth. China would be the world champion GDP per capita in Asia in 2050. The difference between opening up, globalization, and self-reliance, going backward, decoupling, is a staggering $22,500 per capita, GDP per capita in 2050. So you have to keep in mind $22,500 GDP per capita. That's what they pay in order to be self-reliant. That's what they deny every single citizen to actually have. By the way, it's last year, according to the World Bank, or 2020, it was 16,800. So in a way, yeah, growth is there. But as a matter of fact, China's leadership, if they really want to go down this road of decoupling, actually hurts its own citizens' well-being. So much for common prosperity. And now, of course, the question is even more dramatic. If Alicia asked me how long there's a huge imbalance in demographics, I think 114 men are for 100 women. So that's already very stressful for young men. But at the same time, you have an aging society where basically they're finding it hard to get a job. And history tells us that this is the most volatile group. So the only difference in order to speed up the process is, unfortunately, the power of the street. Now, this might be very nasty, and I don't hope it's going to end up like this. I lived here in the early 1989. I've witnessed this. It was not good for China. It was good for nobody. So we want really to have a strong vaccination program, to have people self-testing at home, staying at home, to open up the economy domestically. They cannot open up the borders yet. But when they have a strong vaccination and the acceptance of the people that, yes, you might have 100 people dying every day in China, which is, by the way, much less than flu, then you can live with this. You know, China lives with 1 million people dying because of smoking every year, 1 million. So there seems to be an acceptance of, yeah, you know, it's this. But there in COVID, it's so deep rooted, the fear about this disease, that to say, oh, let's not go down this road. So we have to have a change in thinking. China has a huge potential. China can manage this. They have the management to do so. You just have to give the reins to those people that actually can implement it. There is a risk involved, of course. But again, Germany has opened up totally, and I think we stopped counting at 100,000 cases a day. My son has twice COVID. My daughter has COVID, you know, and that was Delta. So it's not a death sign. And the people just have to realize that you can live with that. You can live with Omicron. But do you think that the CCTV or the newspapers report how other countries are opening, like Spain is opening up, for example? Of course not. That would mean that China looks ugly. But at the same time, you want to instill this kind of confidence. We can do it. China can do it. But they don't let this happen.
Thank you. And I'm looking at Alicia, especially because you mentioned several times in this comprehensive reply to my question about the fact that China can still keep growing to a certain extent, even in this situation. And Alicia, you've been analyzing that, you know, how in such a situation China can match its growth ambitions and targets. So perhaps Before we move towards the end of these episodes, because we don't have that much time to spend still, but that could be an interesting analysis, because you've been looking into the actual nitty-gritty numbers and as well measures that, at least on the paper, would keep these targets matched.
Thank you, Giuseppe. Let me tell you that jump twice, you know, on the air. Like, I want, first jump is I want to kill COVID, even Omicron. Yeah, nobody can, but I want. Second jump in the air is I want to grow 5.5%. Can I do that? Yeah. Yes, but what are the consequences of these two things together? So basically, with some assumptions on investment in real estate, which we see now are facilitating, there's a number of things happening that, as Girk said, I pay the mortgage for you, or I make it easier, but you know, you can't even go and buy. Yeah, but still, I mean, all of this financial support that I think is going to happen, if that takes place, plus infrastructure investment gets all the way to 18%. 18% annual growth is, just to give you a sense, we think the beginning of the year was magnificent and it only grew 8%. Last year, I mean, let's go back, forget about COVID. 18, 19, it grew around 3. So imagine 18%. So say you go lambastic, yeah, on infra. And not sure with whom, because if they are in lockdown. But anyway, say you find a place in China where you can still dig, maybe in the rural areas. Fine. What is this all about? I mean, by 2022, you may have put an additional, I don't know, 10 percentage points of GDP in debt. You know, what for? It's very unproductive, possibly infrastructure investment, because you're doing it in a rush. It reminds me of my home country, you know, when Zapatero was a PM, prime minister, and he started digging all, I mean, because he needed to spend this money for Spain to grow. Of course, Spain is not China, but what I'm trying to say is that you just can't grow out of a problem in a rush with something you know you don't need. Because maybe China still needs infra, but you need to think it through, you know, doesn't have to be, especially in the midst of lockdowns. So maybe they manage to do both, but it won't be successful. Because first, even if you stop this Omicron wave, a new one may come because you still don't have herd immunity. I mean, it's not that because you stop this one, it's going to be over. Second, whatever bullets you have left in terms of fiscal space, you are using them. That's the point I'm trying to make. It's not that it is impossible, but it is unwarranted, which is possibly even worse than impossible. I don't know. Girk maybe wants to add, but I just wanted to make that this point.
I just wanted to add maybe a positive note on this one. China has the ability to get out of this. If they change tack, if they get away from political-driven and propaganda-fed stability to taking a risk and actually educating its people that there is life beyond lockdowns, and that would help already our headquarters to convince that China has a plan. The problem we have is we don't see a plan. We don't see a timeline. When Alicia was asking, when is it going to be over? I mean, I have no clue. And again, the surveys you see these days are so bleak, you know. It's nearly impossible to stay positive, but I want to be positive because we all know the potential of China, about the market size, and in particular also that we know about the abilities of Chinese engineers and the innovation power of the private sector and so forth. But it all seems to be geared toward SOEs and crack down, and the toolbox of the zero tolerance is only one item, it's the sledgehammer. So it can't go on like this. And that's why I've been speaking up and hope that other people speak up more. It's like China should have the self-confidence, we can do this. And we're all in there together. I think that can be achieved, but it can only be achieved if communication improves and a bit of honesty. How difficult transition is, and saying there might be some issues happening. Maybe also Taiwan could be a good example if it fixes its inherent problems. But again, we have seen other countries that came out of it and managed a spike, like Korea, for example. So it is possible, and leadership should not be too timid about this change.
Thank you, Jörg. And we could go on for much longer, and definitely we are keeping discussing all these issues with Alicia in the next episodes of The Sound of Economics. But unfortunately, this is all the time we have for this episode. And I just want to remind that this conversation was part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter Zhongguan Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. And as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Jörg, Alicia, thanks a lot for joining this conversation.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you, Jörg.
Thank you very much. And stay safe and stay positive. Not in testing.
Thanks so much to bring us this this positive note and trying to also end with this positive note. It's not easy in this situation. So thanks for this this help in our thinking. And of course, I would like to thank all our listeners for following us and tuning in to this episode as well as the World Podcast. So until next time, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.